Okay.
Buenos dias, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig.
And next, Ann's going to do Bengali, and then she's going to do Polish. And then she's going to do Belgian.
I don't think so.
Which is either French.
Yeah, there you go.
Wonderful. So today's program is all about ethnic. Mostly ethnic food, but a little liquid beverage at the end.
Which matches well, just
to match up well with the wonderful foods that we're going to talk about. And pride of place at the beginning of the program goes to Mexico. Correct?
Yeah, Roberto. Yes.
Roberto Santabinez has been on.
He's wonderful.
Yeah, he's been on the program before, but he has a new take on how to cook Mexican authentically and successfully and beautifully. So let's hear what he has to say.
Well, we like people who are fun, Roberto Santabinez, and that's why we like to have you on the Menu Radio.
Thank you. You are fun,
and this new book of yours is also fun. It's called Tacos, Tortas, and Tamales.
Right.
Yeah, and you have classics in here in all those categories, and then you let your really wild and wonderful imagination soar in making up new versions of these classics. And that's, I really love those.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, I am pretty creative, I think.
Uh-huh.
I love to tweak, but with a lot of respect to my past, to our traditions and to our flavor platform. I always believe we have a platform of flavors, textures, and colors that define exactly who we are and what we eat. And that's why you can recreate something and invent something on top, as long as you respect those parameters.
Now, your previous book addressed the various regional cuisines, right?
Right, more by techniques and stuff, yes.
Yes. And this one, as I said, you cover tacos, tortas, tamales, but then you also have sauces and condiments, drinks, and desserts. So this is a good read. Now, how did you go about, I mean, you started out by saying how diverse culinary traditions of Mexico are. And that's probably the basis of your mission in this book, right? I mean, you're really proving it with the kind of recipes you include.
Yes.
And some of them can't tell if they're classics or if they're inventions.
Some of them. You were having a good laugh with me about my salchicha torta, which is to me, that's a classic.
Is it really? That's hot
dogs. I was born and raised in a city that's what you ate.
Hot dogs.
Hot dog tortas. And or hot dogs in the street. Our hot dogs in the street have pico de gallo and avocado. It's so delicious.
Oh, well, I'm sure. Anything with pico de gallo and avocado.
pico jalapenos, pico de gallo, mayo, and mustard.
Uh-huh. All of it.
On your hot dog.
All of it.
Yeah.
Right. Uh-huh.
Delicious.
You talked about guacamole. Have you been to Empion Cocina?
I have, yes.
Did you have their guac?
I did. I enjoyed it.
I loved it. I mean, that's not at all classic, is it? And it has pistachios and pistachio oil and lime juice. I loved it.
Right. It was very nice.
About this one, the sardine torta? And a torta is a sandwich, right?
Yes, it's basically the typical Mexican sandwich built on a roll, like a bolillo.
Yeah, well, you say this is a funky classic eaten by construction workers.
Right.
And it's sort of, it's not exactly haute Mexican. You start by saying, drain a small can of sardines.
Yes.
Invert it into a roll and top with queso fresco, avocado, and pickled jalapenos.
Are you making the picture? It's delicious.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the kind of thing I'd love. So you say that is a classic.
A total classic. Very old, known, very well known that builders and people in the street do that. They go buy a can of sardines and put it in a piece of bread and season it up.
Yeah, it's the seasoning that does it. Bologna sandwich or your taco with mortadella.
That's Peter's favorite.
it's really kind of special. But one of the reasons it's special is because of all the things you put in it.
So it's not just a
cheese sandwich. I mean, it's pickled and salsa in it.
Yeah, there's pickles. There's always something that ignites. It's the fun of Mexican food. Never just plane. There's always something that ignites you up, that gives you a kick, and that's the fun.
Yeah, well, your writing is fun, too. I mean, we both were laughing about this. You write about the tacos de higaditos, is that it? You say, I get giddy when I spot chicken liver lurking in the cazuelas at the small shops and market stalls that sell tacos de guisado. So you get giddy, huh?
I do. It's really it's such a fun country for food.
Even though there are 25 million others trying to get to eat at the same time.
I know. Isn't it a miracle? My city is a miracle.
It's a miracle that it works at all.
Exactly. What I always say is you go into this great hotel. We stayed at a hotel last time I went because my house was full with all my sisters and everything. It's amazing. You open the faucet and clear, chlorine water comes out.
Something you don't exactly expect.
Exactly. Like, wow, this city is a miracle.
Well, I remember a couple of things that happened when I was in Mexico. The first time I was there on my own, Anne came down with me the first time. I did some work down there for General Motors, which is why I was there so often. But we used to go to Toluca. Our work site was Toluca. So we would take a taxi to Toluca in the morning. And then coming home, when it was time to come home, we'd call a taxi which would drive up from Mexico City and then take us back. And we thought, well, that seemed like a sort of like a silly thing to do. Why didn't we just get a taxi in Toluca? So we did. So we're in the cab going back to Mexico City. All of a sudden, there are two of us. We realize we don't speak Spanish, and we're trying to explain to the taxi driver that we want to go to the JW Marriott, and I don't think he'd ever been there. And we're approaching Mexico City and trying to figure out how are we going to tell him how to get to where we're going.
Oh, my God.
And it was so funny. We finally found it together, and we tried to get a receipt, a recibo from the taxi driver, and he didn't seem to understand what one of those was. So we figured, well, we'll get one tomorrow from the taxi company. So we get back to Toluca's day. And we say, where do we get a receipt for this taxi driver? It turned out he had not turned in the money. We gave him the fare, which is quite a lot, and he never turned it into the company. I guess he just quit and took the money and went somewhere else.
God.
Adventures.
No, we had a lot of adventures.
Now, I never even thought of dessert tamales. Is that common?
Yes, of course. Very, very common. We eat sweet tamales all the time.
Yeah, you have a recipe here for coconut tamales.
Delicious.
It sounds good, doesn't it?
Oh, and the other ones, the strawberry ones, oh my God, those are my favorite.
Now, there was one you had where you describe it as the approach to the dish. It's when friends are coming over. And basically, you put a mound of is it tamale dough? Is that the right way to describe it?
Right.
And then the pot with the filling in, and then people make their own.
Right, but it's fun. It's sort of like a family thing. You gather, you put your soaking leaves. To make tamales between friends is a great thing to pass the afternoon.
That sounded like fun for me, too.
Yeah, well, you remember we were in that restaurant with Mario, who was our host from General Motors, and we went to this restaurant, and they had tamales on the dinner menu, but not on the lunch menu. And for some reason, Mario decided we should have tamales, but they wouldn't bend. They would only serve tamales at dinner. It didn't matter how many times he asked them in his beautiful Spanish, they still weren't going to give him any.
Right.
It seemed somehow unfair.
Now, which of these salsas do you think is, like, the most inventive that you came up with?
Pecan and chipotle.
That sounds good.
Of the most delicious spread you can ever do in Mexican cooking. It's incredibly delicious.
Wow.
You should try it.
Is it easy to make?
It's very easy to make. You just need chipotles and pecans.
Okay.
And a piece of onion.
You have a whole section here on drinks. Now,
yes.
What kinds of, I mean, the smoothies I can see with all the wonderful fruits you have, huh?
Right. Have you seen the pictures of the stands?
And, of course, horchata.
The stands where you go buy those things are full of boxes of juice, of fruits, and it's incredible. It's an old tradition.
Right. You say that you always, when you're there, you always... You're always eating on the street, so to speak.
Yeah.
And drinking, right?
It's a problem because everything's good.
Now, I thought everyone drank cerveza, but they really don't.
But yeah, that's the other side of the story.
So that's allowed as well, huh? Dos Equis is allowed, huh?
It is allowed, completely. completely.
So most people think of margaritas when they think of Mexico, but you really go way beyond that with your drinks, don't you?
Yeah. Well, actually, I think you don't find very good margaritas in Mexico City. Nobody really knows how to make them well. Margarita is an American thing. It's an American cocktail that sort of started here and then went down to Mexico, but Mexicans don't know how to execute it properly.
I see. Yeah. I like the tequila with the sangrita is my favorite thing to drink there.
I love that, too. That's one of my favorite things. But our drinks are very fun. I do love making the infusions of the hibiscus. That one, you should do that one. That's a delicious, delicious drink.
Yeah, anything with hibiscus I love. And what's a torito?
Toritos are from Veracruz, and they're very simple because they basically just put aguardiente and any fruit purees that they have, and they drink those parties. There are some in my book made of peanuts, for example. That's delicious.
Peanut torito.
Yeah.
And so you used actual peanut butter in it.
Delicious.
Yeah, with Mexican cinnamon. I never understood there's a difference between Mexican cinnamon and regular cinnamon, and there's a difference between Mexican oregano and regular oregano. What are the differences?
In the cinnamon, there are two complete different species. The one you use here in the States is actually called cassia, and it should be called cassia. It's not cinnamon. Cinnamon is the only one that it's one bark that is the one Mexicans use.
Uh-huh. And where does it
come? Funnily enough, it's not Mexican. It comes from Sri Lanka.
That's what I was going to say, yeah.
But they call it Mexican because it's the cinnamon that all Mexicans use. And it's different. It's completely different. It's more complex in aromas. It's got more scents and more complexity. And it doesn't have heat. Your cinnamon, it comes to a point where if you use too much, there's a spiciness to it.
Yes, there is.
Not in ours.
And it does something to the blood pressure, too, doesn't it?
It helps out, I think, no? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think it's helpful to blood
pressure. It's a sort of like an anti-inflammatory. That's the main difference.
Uh-huh.
And that's what we can use so much in so many things. Our cinnamon is never spicy. It's just incredibly smooth and complex, and it just adds layers of complexity to anything you put it on.
And Roberto,
you were asking about oregano, too.
And, you know, the Mexican oregano is different.
Yeah, oregano is actually, our oregano is closer to a marjoram.
Okay. So
they're all related, but it's closer to that than to the typical Greek oregano.
Okay. Yeah, well, they're both, marjoram and oregano are the same family, I know that, yeah.
Right, right.
Now, I want to get your take on this. We've suddenly gotten a whole bunch of books about Latin cuisine and Mexican cuisine, too. We have the big Diana Kennedy book, and we have we have a bunch of Mexican. What is it that's going on? And then we also have other Latin cuisines, because we did Jose Garces' Latin Road Home. Now, they've been predicting this great resurgence of interest in Latin American food for quite some time now, but this seems to be the year for it. Why do you think that is?
I truly don't know, but I do think it's because, well, first in anything, the strength and the power of the overall Latin population in this country trying to say, here, you know, and we are good and we can do this and we can show the world that we have world-level cuisine. And I think that's basically it, but it has been lately more than ever before. You're talking about the food world, but you look around and there's new Latina magazine for ladies, and there's new, and they all have come up in the past couple of years, like you say.
And there's a whole website on all things Latina.
Right. It's amazing. Latina markets, Latino magazines, and it's incredible. It's very, very, very incredible. And like you say, every 2 weeks there's a new Latino restaurant opening.
Right.
New York, it's crazy. I was just in one yesterday that opened up like a week ago.
What was it?
It was a little sort of place on Spring Street.
Spring, yeah, I know Spring. I know Spring from the old days.
Yeah, it wasn't that great, but new one. People are going, and it's just a big thing.
Right. But all we have to really do, if you want to eat Mexican in New York City or in Brooklyn, you can go to Fonda.
Fonda.
Either one of them.
Either one of them.
And there's a website. Let's just record the website in. It's fondarestaurant.com.
Fondarestaurant.com. Easy.
So if you don't want to get this book and learn how to cook from it yourself, there is a way out. But we think that it looks to us like these recipes are quite straightforward. There's a section in the back where you have a listing of where you can get ingredients if your local shop doesn't happen to have them. So you have no excuse, really.
No excuse. With the internet nowadays, you can get anything at home in a couple of days.
Well, this is a good guide for people who just feel kind of lost with the flavors of Mexico. This tells you what they are and even then some. And we thank you, Roberto Santibanez.
Thank you both. It has been really fun and wonderful.
Yes, and I look forward to your next book.
You certainly will get one.
And before we go whizzing across the planet from the new world to the old world, we'll just take a quick break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You know, there seems to be some great revival of interest in Polish cooking, which seems unlikely in view of the emphasis on lighter foods these days. But at any rate, we did do rose petal jam a while back, and coming is a book called Classic Polish Desserts, which we haven't got yet, but we'll do. And here we are in Polish Kitchen, which is really actually a lightening up of some of the classic Polish
dishes. Yeah, I think the deal is that there are a lot of people with a Polish heritage, and I think they're sort of rediscovering it now that their nation, the nation of their birth has become an independent country again, and out of the decades and decades and decades of dominance by Germany and then Russia. So I think there's a new pride in their country, and it's reflected in the fact that they're also looking for their cuisine as well. So I think that's the reason why. Anyway, let's see what Polish country cooking is all about.
Looking through some of the introductory photos of this book called From a Polish Country House Kitchen, I feel that there's sort of a dream sequence unfolding of part of something that's happened before. It's something we're heading towards in a poetic sort of way, and yet the recipes are very modern and down to earth. We're talking to Danielle Crittenden, who is the co-author with Ann Applebaum, and it was, you'll have to tell us the story. Danielle, I should mention that you are actually the international editor of the online...
I'm the international editor at Huffington Post. Okay. Everywhere.
Everywhere. It's quite a job. So, and this is not your first book, but it's your first cookbook.
That's right. As I wrote in our introduction, we both wrote an introduction to the cookbook, and describing Anne and myself as both unlikely cookbook writers. I've written on politics. I've written fiction. I live in Washington, D.C. My career has...
You write a lot of fiction, huh?
Well, I'm not the one writing the fiction. You can argue the politicians are. And Anne is, of course, she's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. She's a columnist, and she's been reporting on Eastern Europe since the Cold War, just before communism fell, which is probably around the time we met each other and became friends. And she married the Polish man who was a journalist then, had worked for Solidarity, and is now the Polish foreign minister, Radek Sikorski. So she has long been interested in that part of the world, and right after communism fell, the two of them bought this old manor house in a part of the country that Radek had grown up in, and it was completely tumbled down. It had animals living in it. I think it had tenants still living in it. And they completely rebuilt it from ground up, and it was then, like 3 years ago or so, that they invited my husband and me and some other friends over to visit them, and we hadn't been to Poland since last, been just at the fall of communism, and so to go there 12 years, to see this country completely renewed, and not only that, but to see this part of the world that Anne and Radek were in completely renewed, as epitomized by this unbelievable house that they had painstakingly rebuilt and the gardens that they had recreated and the food, which was amazing and seemed to symbolize Poland's rebirth most of all into freedom, into a Western society, and also food that was reaching back beyond before communism, back to its tradition, back to its wonderful exotic flavors and yet reproducing them in a very modern way. And that was what was so striking to all of us who visited Anne and Radek at their house. And Anne and I both love to cook. We're lay cooks. I mean, we entertain and adore cooking. And to see Anne in this house going out in the morning and collecting plums and bringing them back and then reappearing in a cake after dinner was just magical. And she laughs because she was, at the time, writing another history book called The Iron Curtain, which just came out at the same time as this cookbook as well. But I cornered her in her kitchen. I said, Anne, we have to write this cookbook. We have to base it on your house and this whole incredible revival of Poland. And so basically I bullied her into doing this. And she said, well, I can't. I don't have time. I'm writing this history. I said, I'll help you, Anne. I'll help you, but we have to do this. And so we did. And it's been both a work of food, obviously, and cooking, but it's also been an adventure in through history. It, I think, quite literary in parts. Like every recipe that we present has, Anne has written some wonderful background or anecdote or historical context for where these recipes have come from, where they've been unearthed. So it's a big book, and I'm glad you loved the illustrations because it does make Poland look magical, and Poland actually is. Many people have impressions of it that are sort of from the war or from communism, and they associate the food with that as well.
Yeah,
and in fact, they miss this incredible revival that has taken place.
In fact, the immigrants to the United States, we have a bunch of pierogies, but that was peasant food.
Yes, as was Italian food, by and large. What I compared to the revival in Poland is similar to what we saw in the revival in, you know, with Tuscany and Tuscan food. That when you think about it, a lot of what our associations, and this, by the way, was my actual interest in the Polish food, not just this beautiful house, but my own associations and connections to Poland are through my husband and through Judaism. His family descends a lot from Poland, as so many North American Jewish families do, and I'm Jewish, and so a lot of that food that we think of as Jewish food comes up at Passover,
yeah.
Gefilte fish and all that, is actually Polish food, and it arrived, as you say, with sort of poor immigrants at the turn of the last century, and then it sort of became, if you remember, the reputation of Italian food in the 1950s. It met the riches of American ingredients. It became heavy. It became cheesy, associated with spaghetti and pizza. And it was only after sort of it got taken back, like with through Marchesan, through these other Italian writers who brought us Tuscan food, Northern Italian food, as it was in its purity. And it's quite light and flavorful, and it's based on simple ingredients, but then magic is done with those, whether it's in the simmering or the spices or whatever. And Polish food is like that. It's of a simple background, and it's based on, obviously, much harsher winters than Italy has. And so there's a lot of big running joke with how many recipes could you get out of potatoes, but there's a lot of root vegetables and cabbages and all very simple cuts of meat, although there's a lot of game in Poland, so we did bring in some recipes for boar and venison, and which is becoming also more popular over here. But taking simple ingredients and what doing magic with them, simmering with them, adding the, not just the spice like dill that we associate with Poland, like dill over everything, but parsnips, and there's certain types of little bitter elements in their soups, quail's eggs. There were so many exotic additions that we found in the new sort of Polish cooking that is based on the old Polish cooking, and it's much lighter and healthier and flavorful than what the average person, especially the average North American person, and more particularly the average North American Jewish person associates with Polish cooking. So yes, we've got, you know, chicken soup, and we've got all
that's what
sort
we're
of basics, but
yeah,
but our cabbage rolls, for instance, are made with turkey. They're light as air, very delicate. The Polish expression for them is little doves. And they are little doves. They're very translucent, young cabbage wrapped around turkey and rice, and then with a wild mushroom sauce. It's completely different from the usual association with cabbage rolls as being like heavy tomato, porky thing. So that was really fun, sort of turn these stereotypes on their head and capture what is going on in a lot of the new Polish restaurants in Warsaw and elsewhere, where they are experimenting with these very traditional foods, but in new and fascinating ways and delicious ways.
Now, forgive me, my knowledge of the history of Europe and the history of the Kingdom of Poland and Germany and Russia on either side He's a bit sketchy, and I'm sensing my recollection that there was a kingdom of Poland a long time before there was a country called Germany. But is Polish cooking sort of like anywhere else? I mean, is it like Romania, or is it like Bulgarian, or is it like Russian, or is it just distinctively it's just Polish?
Well, it's interesting, and Anne writes a lot about the history of it throughout the book. She touches on it, and she points out Napoleon walked through there at one point, so there's a lot of French influence.
Yeah, I was going to say that I thought when Poland was in its age of enlightenment, the dominant influence in aristocratic circles of cuisine was French.
I guess Napoleon went one way quick, and then the other way even quicker.
Well, and also, and at that time, Poland's cuisine was very highly regarded. But then also in that area, as you know, and I think everybody's history tends to be sketchy because the borders keep changing. So in minute areas, so for example, the place where Anne's and Roddick's house is now could have been part of Russia, like the borders just all kept flipping around. So there are many influences. There are strains of Hungarian, there are strains of Russian, the whole Eastern European quiz that we associate with Eastern European quiz. There are similarities, but there are things that are distinctly Polish that we write about. And
my next question is that you've modernized these, but you say you've done so in the spirit of Poland. And so I was wondering, what are the key things, ingredients, techniques, whatever it is, that you view as, I would say, quintessentially Polish that you've kept in your recipe?
Well, I think the main discovery, and this was for me as an outsider with some familiarity stumbling into it, Anne would be much more precise knowing the area better and the regional cuisine better of saying exactly what is uniquely Polish or not. What I found was remarkable, there's one soup, and it's called a white barsz, you can pronounce it, barczyk, which is barsz or borscht, what we think of as borscht, and think of as being made up with beet. And this is actually called there's no beet. No beet comes near this soup. And there is something that they take this bread and they ferment it. And you can buy it in Polish markets now pre-fermented. And it sounds kind of disgusting, but it really, really isn't. You'll just have to trust me on this.
No, I'm in a fermentation mode these days, so I understand.
And so this soup is this, it's got chunks of sausage in it, and it's a sort of slightly creamy and delicious, rich, very good wintry soup, very good, like, as a meal in itself with just some thick slices of bread on the side, and then this rye sort of liquid that you stir in at the last minute, and it gives it it's almost like sourdough bread. If you imagine that, you apply that to the flavor of the soup. And this is a very distinctive Polish soup that is completely delicious. Our kids were over with us when we were photographing in the book, and they'd never seen that, you know, you never come across a soup anywhere in the world, and they'd never had it, and they just would order it at every chance they got. Another one is Hunter's stew, or bigos, as it's called. And this is a very distinctive Polish stew that has a mixture of meats and usually unfailingly includes game, but would pretty much depend on what you had kicking around your freezer or, I guess, what you'd hunted. So beef, some venison, and maybe some pork or even chicken. I can't remember which different combination we put in. But then it also has some sauerkraut and then some spices, and then we, in our version, which comes from Anne's mother-in-law, and everybody, as you can imagine, there is very guarded and has their own version of bigos, or so each, it can vary from household to household, but all Poles will recognize the word bigos and some variation of this type of stew, and you simmer the hell out, cooks and cooks, and you can keep it, like, a lot of these kinds of dishes on the stove for days, just heating it up every day, adding some more things to it. I was the food tester for all of these recipes, and so I tested them in my Washington kitchen, and I tested them on what I called my Polish food crash test dummies of my American friends. So I really wanted a fresh audience for this food to see if it would play over here. And they would just be knocked out by this stew. It was just nothing like you've ever had, and that is a very distinctive Polish dish. So the combination of the sauerkraut and the game, and then this case with prunes, I think is fairly uniquely Polish. So is our recipe for pickle soup. Everybody associates pickles with Poland, and we have a pickle soup, which we've called sour cucumber soup, but it's really pickle soup, which also sounds sort of crazy until you realize it's like a beautiful dilly potato soup, also great at this time of year, and exotic and delicious, and makes a meal in itself.
And as you said, your subtitle for your book is 90 Recipes for the Ultimate Comfort Food.
Right.
And isn't that what it's all about, particularly in cold climate like that, huh?
Right. Stews and roasts and roasted vegetables. And then in the summer, we have a version. This is another very distinctively Polish dish that I never come across and found very exotic. Again, we all know what we call familiarly as borscht, and we have a couple of recipes for that. One of quite modern one with a sort of balsamic vinegar twist to it. One more traditional. And then they have what they call a summer barczyk in Poland, and it is its basis kefir, or even a kind of light yogurt with beets, with cucumbers. I was joking; it was like a Polish gazpacho. It's served cold, but the beets, chopped beets, all run into the yogurty base, and it becomes streaked pink like a sunset. And then you put these chopped hard-boiled eggs in it, and again, it's so exotic to see, for me, to see hard-boiled eggs in a soup, something, again, we don't really encounter over here, but this beautiful, chilled, cucumbery, beady, yogurty soup with hard-boiled eggs. And that's, again, very simple ingredients, very tasty, but a lighter summer dish, not relying on stewing or the potato.
Well, I think this book is going to be a revelation to a lot of people.
Yeah, none of these snide comments about pierogies and Polish food anymore.
No.
Well, we do have pierogies, but they're like dim sum now if you go to Poland. I mean, you can still get, obviously, the traditional heavy style. And we have a recipe for the ruski, as it's called, with just potatoes, cheese, and peas.
Yes.
But we also, I had fun playing with, and now when you go over there to restaurants, you can get all kinds of one. And the one we came up with is got duck and red cabbage in a orange Cointreau butter sauce. So you can have a lot of fun with these things, too. And they're much lighter, and you can make them small, and then they're not at all horribly heavy or potentially fattening and things
like
that.
And don't forget the vodka. You have a lot of recipes for vodka in here.
By the way, I made one over this Christmas. We tested all of them, but I remade one for this Christmas, which was a honey ginger. And vodka, of course, as you know, once you ferment it, it becomes all kinds of other things. And this was, I know your throat is croaky.
Yes,
it only takes 2 weeks to ferment. Honestly, this was among the tastiest things I've ever drank. I was pouring it for friends who were drinking way too much of it, but it was just sweet and exotic and lovely. And, yeah, so we have a number of those that, especially through January and February, might make the months a bit lighter if you can lighten them up by making your own homemade hooch.
Yeah. Well, Danielle, you sound like you've had quite an adventure with your friend and co-writer in Poland and in producing this beautiful book. And I hope it does very well. And I hope that we get a new take on Polish cuisine as a result of your doing this. I know it was an enormous amount of work to do this.
Yes. Well, it was a lot of fun, and it was really a work of love. And thank you for appreciating it, and thank you for having me on.
I'm delighted. Thank you, Danielle.
And we're going to keep on heading east right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are, and as promised, we're going to begin conversing in Bengali. Just kidding.
Yeah. Fortunately, the traditional language of Bengal and Bangladesh is English anyway. So,
is it really?
So we would get by, I think. And a very interesting take on a very interesting cuisine that is a mystery to many. But after you listen to our next guest, it won't be so mysterious anymore.
I always say that I strive to learn at least one new thing a day, and I think this book, The Bengali Five Spice Chronicles, helped me out for an entire week. We're going to be talking to Rinku Bhattacharya, who you're illuminating something that I knew nothing about, which is Bengali cuisine. So, I mean, it's a region in India, straddling eastern India and Bangladesh, right?
Yes.
And it's known for its gastronomy, but yet there aren't any cookbooks around. Why is that?
That's a great question. There are some, but they are far and few between. I guess partly, oftentimes, Bengalis feel it's a homestyle cuisine. They don't take the time to write the cooking because the food has passed from generation to generation. I myself, when I moved to the U.S., had a very hard time finding a book from which I could learn. I had to spend a lot of time calling my mother, talking to people, which is one of the reasons I actually wrote this book. I thought, you know what, it would be nice for me to actually formally consolidate all these notes that I have.
So you embarked on this, and how did you decide to approach it? The title gives a clue, right?
Yes.
The Five Spice. Now, tell us the significance of this Five Spice.
It is one of the more popular spices in Bengali cuisine. It's a whole spice blend consisting of five spices that are supposed to take you through the whole palate universe. It's comprised of cumin, black mustard, fenugreek, nigella, and fennel. And the most common use of this five blend is oil is heated, and the five spices are added to hot oil. I just happen to like the spice blend a lot because I feel just by having a jar of one consolidated spice blend, I can taste and smell my mother's kitchen, which is why I named this book after it. It's not the only spice used in Bengali cooking. Other popular spices are mustard, both in fresh and in whole seed form. Coconut is used a lot in Bengali cooking.
So coconut palms must be native to Bengal, huh?
It's coastal India. You do see a lot of use of coconut in South Indian cooking as well.
Now, there's a Chinese spice called Five Spice as well, but that's...
Yes, that's very different, though.
So very... Okay, so just the common thing is five.
Yes, yes. Actually, interestingly enough, when I was writing this book, I first came up with the Five Spice Chronicles, and my editor told me, you know, there are lots of Five Spice blends, so we need to put in the word Bengali so that people know that's what you're talking about.
But there are a lot of really unusual recipes in here. I never heard of eating a banana blossom.
Banana blossoms are, well, used in other parts of Asia, but yes, that is something that's very distinct to Bengali cooking. We actually, along with the coconut trees, you see a lot of banana trees all across the Bengal landscape. And Bengali cooking is also very sustainable. The banana plant, we pretty much use almost all parts of it that's edible, including the stems. And the leaves are used as makeshift plates, which kind of makes a lot of sense because they are biodegradable, unlike styrofoam plates.
Now, you started saying about distinguishing characteristics of Bengali cuisine. What are some of the other ones? Touch on a little bit the spiciness. How does this dish, or how does this cuisine differ from regular other Indian cuisines?
The general emphasis of spicing is subtle, rather than having a whole composition of spices. We also tend to have, on a typical Bengali plate, more dishes. These are usually lighter stir fries, particularly vegetarian dishes, that sort of use one spice or two spices each, rather than having one complex dish that combines a lot of them. For example, some of the spices in the Five Spice blend, nigella seeds in particular, is used a lot with just ginger for simple seasonings. We tend to use a lot of fish in our diet, and we use a lot of freshwater fish. That's also very distinct to the Bengali table.
I see. Now, you include in here techniques, culinary terms, and I must say many of them I have never ever heard of. So this is a revelation, this book, and this whole cuisine.
A lot of the background I tried to put in just so that if someone generally wanted to get an idea of some of the terminology, the culture, and the history, I thought it would make for interesting reading along with the recipes.
And then you have essential tools and general tips, and you include things. I never even heard of a coconut scraper.
Well, I'd love to say that's unique to Bengal, but it is used in a lot of parts of India where we use coconut.
Now, you have sort of like meal plans. You talk about how meals are served, and you've already touched on that with a lot of individual dishes instead of everything mixed together. And then you have like a daily meal planning thing.
Mm-hmm.
which is the kind of thing you'd expect on a daily basis. And then you talk about special occasions. Now, what happens with special occasions?
Special occasions for the Bengali is all about food and then the occasion. But it varies. For example, there are certain religious occasions that have distinct foods prepared. We recently went through something that we call a winter harvest festival. What's very common is we make a lot of homemade desserts, and we use things like rice and coconut because the harvest, again, in West Bengal consists of these two. This is just the example of a special occasion that has typical foods.
Now, weddings are big time, right? And I read, although I imagine it's not usually the case anymore, that you can have a wedding last for 5 days.
Yes, it's probably once upon a time you would have the wedding start at the bride's house with something that was kind of the equivalent of the bridal shower. Then there'd be a whole load of ancillary festivals leading on to the wedding. This would take about 3 days. Then the bride and the groom would leave and go to the groom's house. And there'd be a whole series of festivities there, ending with the groom's wedding reception. And this would be in about another 2 days. So this is how I get the 5 days.
So it's quite an expensive proposition getting married in Bengal.
Well, people don't quite have the time or the energy anymore to have these five-day weddings, but people still love the weddings, and it's a big deal, as it is here and anywhere else in the world.
Now, you grew up in Bengal, but somehow you found your way to New York. How did that happen?
To be honest, I came to graduate school in Connecticut and then started working in New York, like the area. I find I have actually lived more than half my life now in the New York area.
Now, is it easy for you to be able to get the ingredients to make
yes.
these things?
Yes.
I mean, some of them seem quite exotic.
Yeah, increasingly over the, I'd say, past decade or so, the world just seems to be a smaller place. Earlier, I'd have to go to specific stores to pick up some of the stuff. These days, I tend to visit them fairly once in a while basis. Your regular supermarkets tend to have quite a few of the day-to-day things.
Yeah, we had an Indian store. Is it still here? The place where I bought the carrot pickle?
Well, we have a couple of them. It's carrot pickle. I don't know what the shelf life of it is, but I'm sure this exceeds 12 years old that we have in the refrigerator.
I probably had it at least a decade. It's really good.
It's probably matured to perfection by now.
It didn't kill anybody yet.
Nothing. No germs could live in that thing. when there are
only two people in the house, a jar of carrot pickle goes a long way.
Oh, if you were to point to some of your most favorite dishes out of this book, what would you point people to?
I'd point people to the chapter on vegetables. There are a lot of quick-fix stir-fries. I have a stir-fried cabbage with potatoes.
We're having that tonight. What's in that one?
Oh, interesting. One of my favorites, although it's an adapted recipe, is mushrooms and coconut milk. The reason I like this recipe a lot is I've actually adapted a fish recipe for mushrooms for a vegetarian friend, and I happen to like it so much we make it quite a bit. There are a couple of meat-based recipes, like my pickle spiced lamb. I think when the weather is cold, that's a perfect dish. Lentils. I love lentils.
Oh, we do too.
Yes. The chapter on lentils is quite expansive, and I think, again, those have ingredients that most people are familiar with. I mean, so I'd actually encourage people. I've arranged the book almost going from simple to more complex, so I think people started with the earlier chapters and then moved on. They'd get hang of the cooking and also feel comfortable with it as they progress to more complex dishes.
Well, this has got to be a pleasurable adventure for somebody who is not exposed or hasn't been exposed to this style of cooking before. I think it's more unusual than what most people associate with standard Indian cuisine.
Regional Indian cooking actually has a lot of nuances, and Bengali happens to be one of the regions. I think while it's wonderful that now most people understand some of the mainstream dishes, I think to really understand how spices are used, it's really looking at regional Indian cooking that gives you a good idea. I mean, I feel I learn something new every day with Indian cooking. I mean, I hear of something unusual used in some small town in Western India that I've never heard of, and that makes my day.
Oh, that's wonderful.
So we can expect that there might be another book behind this one, huh?
Yeah, maybe on the regions of India.
Uh-huh. Well, look forward to that and look forward to trying this. I have to double-check your potato recipes because Peter's favorite thing in the whole world is, what is it, potatoes with what?
Stir-fried cabbage.
We met a chef from an Indian restaurant in Houston.
Uh-huh.
And she made this wonderful, I don't know whether you'd call it curried potatoes, but it was certainly very spicy potatoes. And the main spice ingredient was fenugreek.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I mean, there were a lot more other things in it. This one happened to have fenugreek.
Yeah, that sounds quite North Indian. I mean, it's a winter time classic where potatoes, my mother-in-law makes it all the time.
Well, I look forward to that.
And what are you having for dinner tonight?
Chicken curry and rice.
Chicken curry and rice. Okay, well, we're having lamb chops, but I suspect that Anne's angling after making something with the cabbage on the side.
All right, wonderful. Yes, that's what I like about that dish, too. It works very well with all kinds of food.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, and thank you for this great contribution to allowing people to understand foods from around the world.
Okay, thank you for having me.
And we'll be back with some liquid refreshment right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Belgium and beer have more than one thing in common. Obviously, they start with the same letter of the alphabet, and it's also important to understand why the Belgian beer tradition is so strong. So a couple of old friends who live, of all things, in Cooperstown, New York, have nevertheless spent the last 30 years of their lives specializing in sourcing, tasting, and importing Belgian beer.
Well, they also lived in Belgium.
Yeah, they lived in Belgium too. Exactly. That was before they moved to Cooperstown, I guess.
Well, let's just listen to their story. We're going to talk to Wendy Littlefield.
Yeah, Wendy, because her husband was off beering in Belgium, I think.
Yeah, and the company is Van Berg and De Wolf, and if you haven't tried their products, you're in for a real treat.
Our next guest, Wendy Littlefield, asked us a very unusual question. She said, how do you guys work together? And we said, with difficulty, of course. We didn't answer that at all. We said, we have two separate offices, and if I want to get something from Anne, I send her an email. And you asked that question for a different reason, I think, than most people do, because you are interested, because you have a similar partnership with your husband, Don.
That's absolutely true. We've been working together now for 31 years in the beer business, and we have kind of the same setup. We have separate offices, and I was saying when we want to have a serious meeting, we leave the house, go somewhere for brunch or go for a walk or go for a canoe ride.
I love that.
Yeah.
No, your business, Van Berg De Wolf. Later, if we have time, we'll have you explain why you called it that, because it certainly isn't a natural name, except it sounds very Belgian. But you got into the Belgian beer business, really by accident.
Yeah.
Go ahead and tell us about it.
Okay, so yes, it was by accident. We were babies. Don and I met in college at Yale and eloped, and he was a year ahead of me, and he found a business school program in Brussels that he could attend, get an American MBA while living abroad. So we took up residence in Belgium. And you can't live in Belgium without noticing that beer is very, 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 very important. So we spent 3 years working in advertising and exploring Belgium and tasting beer and remarking about how extraordinary the beers were. And when our companies were transferring us back to the States, we thought on a whim that we would import beer because it would give us an excuse to go back and visit our friends. Because you know how you move from one place to another and you say, oh, I'm always going to go back and see you.
Right.
But then things change. So the importation of the beer gave us a legitimate excuse to keep going back. And out of that really kind of accidental instinct to become importers, our lives changed dramatically. And really the feeling we had was that beers in Belgium were so extraordinarily good and so varied and so complex that if we brought them to America, people would love them because they were nothing like beers as we knew them in the States.
Now, is that what happened, or was it a little bit harder to sell than you thought?
Well, we would say it was an overnight sensation after 20 years.
Exactly. So it was
never hard. It was always fun, but it wasn't always particularly profitable. For the first 7 years, we both worked in full-time jobs, doing other things to earn money, and did the beer business on the side. And that's actually what took us from New York to Cooperstown. We were professionals in marketing and advertising, and Don raised the venture capital to build Dean and DeLuca.
Oh, really?
That was one of his jobs, yeah, back to his foodie roots. So at that point, we could see that the business would develop, and we moved from New York to a little house in Cooperstown to reduce our expenses and give ourselves the opportunity to try to make it a going venture that would support us for a year. And if it didn't work, we could always go back to New York and our former lives. But it worked.
Now, how does it work? You are the importer of the beer, wholesaler, how does the beer you bring in reach the market?
Well, it's such a very complicated market. You have the three-tier system in the United States. So we approach and have relationships with breweries in Belgium, now France, Italy, Iceland. We say we'd like to import your beers, and then in each case we are the exclusive importers for the whole country. And then we developed over the years, this was part of the early aspect of the business, we developed a distributor network state by state or sometimes county by county, and we appoint those people to be the distributors for our beers. And then the distributor takes the beer to market. So they buy from us, and they sell to restaurants, bars, shops, etc. And then you, as an individual, get it from your local source. That's the way it goes.
Now, are there other people doing that, or are you just about the only game in town when it comes to the range of beers you have from Belgium?
No, there are many, many at this point, because I think there are more than 300 beers from Belgium that are brought to the United States. We were, Van Bergen de Wolf was the first company to specialize in the beers of Belgium. And that was really our stock in trade. And the case we wanted to make was that Belgian beers were eminently worthy of consideration. But once that started to be understood, lots of other people have gone to find other beers, many of them good, and bring them to the country. But just about nobody else really still to this day specializes in Belgium.
Now, I want to ask you two questions, and it's optional for you which order you take them in. How about that? First question is, the beers you bring in are higher quality. They come a long way. They come in relatively small quantities. They're more expensive. So the person who's buying Belgian beer, who's a distributor, is making a statement that says that they're making an investment in product that they really didn't have to make. If they wanted to sell beer, they could buy Budweiser for a whole lot lower price.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first question. There's some price sensitivity always about anything. Surely that must happen with beer. And then the second question is, why is Belgian beer so much better than beers in the rest of the world?
Well, I mean, I think you have to address, if you're addressing the issue of better, you're going to have to address the issue of different and how.
Okay, sure. So go ahead, Wendy.
So those are both very interesting questions, and I'll approach it sort of sideways fashion. The first thing is, when we were building that distributor network, the distributors with whom we were communicating were accustomed to selling product by the container. So industrial lagers, small amount of money on each bottle, a ton of money in general. And we were saying to them, we want you to sell our product by the case, very much more expensive, more in the range of wine prices. And they initially, they would say, why would we do that? Who cares? You know? That's much more complicated. But gradually over time, because it was profitable and it opened new avenues of trade, different types of accounts, they became convinced it was worth doing. On the question of price, more expensive, I actually want to argue now that Belgian beers are a great value. Ounce for ounce, the quality that you get in the bottle is a true bargain if you compare it to any other specialty product, be it cheese, fish, bread, meat, wine. These world-class, intensely complex foods are very inexpensive on an ounce-by-ounce base. The best of the Belgians, like Escaldes Prestige de Nuit Christmas beer, which is $42 a bottle, experts say if that were a wine, it would be at least $150 a bottle. Yeah. The other part is, and the American microbrewers have taken the example of what a Belgian 750-milliliter bottle will sell for, something in the range of $8 to $15 a bottle, let's say. And they have set, they've pegged their prices at or above the Belgians. I'm, as a person who founded Brewery Omegang, that confounds me that the American consumer will put up with that, because the beer has gone through so much less transport and through fewer hands that I still think the beers are a better bargain.
Now, why do they make it so much better?
Well, there are five great brewing nations in the world initially, and they all make great beer. So I wouldn't say that the Belgian beers are better than any other. It's just that Belgium is riotously creative. The country is the size of Maryland and has 1,200 beers, more beer styles, more latitude in what to put into the beers, more association of beer with food than any of the other brewing nations in a deeper, more interesting, more idiosyncratic way. And that's why they're regarded to be so fascinating and why they've had such a huge impact on the craft brewing scene worldwide.
So it's not superior necessarily, but it sure is interesting. It's almost like you would never run out of new beers to try.
Yes. And, of course, the best of them are so superbly well-made that I would say that they're the best of the best anywhere. But it's just the culture of Belgian beer is so rich, varied, complex, and highly individualistic that it's fantastic.
Now, some of the beers have a monastic origin, some don't. Is there any kind of distinction that's important for people to understand?
There are the Trappist monasteries, and you can only say Trappist on your label if the beer is actually made at a Trappist monastery, and that is unique and distinct. And in the consumer's mind, whether it's in Belgium or pretty much anywhere else, there's an association with purity, lack of commercial intent, that carries over to the Trappist beer. So they're special and apart. But then there are many, many beers that are made in the style of Abbey doubles, singles, and triples that can be made by lay breweries, and they can be very good. They're just not Trappist per se.
Now, we did get to watch an interesting program on television in England, which you sadly may never see, but actually you probably would have been snickering the whole time anyway, because the famous British chef Jamie Oliver has a variety of programs on TV. It's almost like he should have his own network like Oprah.
Yeah.
But in this particular case, he got together a group of English brewers. He somehow arranged a competition, a drink-off, between English beers of certain styles and Belgian beers of certain styles.
Mm-hmm.
And he went through all the brewers and how they were making their entrant. And then they took their different six carriers of beers to the Grossmarkt in Brussels.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a taste-off as to which were the best beers.
What was the verdict?
Sadly for Jamie Oliver, I think one of them turned out to be a tie, and the other five all went to Belgium.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah, and there too, 15 years ago or 20 years ago, it really would not have been conceivable to think of chefs making programs about beer, because beer was, as far as the consumer was concerned, too banal, not worthy of a chef's attention. But that has completely and radically changed, and I like to think that's something that we really pioneered and worked hard on. We were, before the official show, we were talking about the James Beard Foundation. We did the first beer dinner at the James Beard Foundation with Michael Jackson and at the Smithsonian and at the Culinary Institute. Yeah, wonderful Michael Jackson.
Yeah. We interviewed him about whiskey instead of about beer.
The funny thing is that when we met him for the first time, it was in the midst of the James Beard supper party after the James Beard Awards one year, And he was sitting in the middle of the ballroom at the Marriott Marquis, and for some reason, I have no idea why, I went up to him and said, "Aren't you Michael Jackson?" Now, I had, to the best of my knowledge, I'd never even seen a picture of him.
Yeah.
It turns out that we were contemporaries in high school. We grew up in the same town called Huddersfield. He went to one grammar school, I went to another, and we never met until we were both over 60 years old.
Isn't that amazing?
And it was such a sad loss, but Michael's up there looking down on us and smiling, I'm sure, about what Van Berg de Wolf is doing.
Oh, he was, well, first of all, he and Don had a wonderful relationship. And what Michael does, so now, because beer is so popular, so many, just about everybody thinks they're an expert, and they often show their expertise or think they're showing their expertise by criticizing things.
Yeah.
What was amazing about Michael is he never criticized anything. He just described it and then let you draw your own conclusions about whether you thought that was bad or good. And it was such a beautiful way of educating people. We need more of that.
Now, Wendy, you don't distribute anything individuals on your through your website, right?
No, we can't. It's because, again, the three-tier system.
Right.
Yeah, we can tell people where to go to buy it.
Well,
but
that's what I was going to say. They can get, I mean, I don't know what number are you at now, how many beers you handle, but every time you sent one, the variety was just so amazing to me. I didn't know there was such a variety because I'm not really a beer person.
Yeah.
But on your website, people can get an idea of what beers you're featuring and that sort of thing.
Oh, it's very, very, very comprehensive, yes. Yeah. So 43 beers from 11 breweries in 4 countries and 20-something different styles. And that number is about to increase because we'll be bringing in Green Jack from the UK starting next month.
So what is the website?
Okay, so it's www.belgianexperts.com. B-E-L-G-I-A-N, like Nancy, experts.
And you have the equivalent of a store finder in a way.
Yes. In fact, the best thing to do is we just completed in November a big party that we call the Coast to Coast Toast. It's the single largest one-day celebration of Belgian beer in the United States. And we had 530 different establishments around the country having a party on the day using our beers. And so that there's a list on the website of those locations. And that's a great place to start, to look the state that you're in and find a place that's close to you. And there is a contact us on the website if somebody doesn't see someplace close or is looking for a particular beer. We will locate a store for them or put them in touch with their closest distributor to get the beer into their hands.
The story goes, Wendy, that there was a gentleman in Britain, I think it was in the 17th or the 18th century, I forget which, and he decided that his life's goal would be to drink a pint of beer in every pub in England and Scotland.
Oh, yeah.
And he was on the second time around when he died. But he had
he had an
excellent and enjoyable life. What I'm going to suggest is that you and Don have a challenge. You have only 43 in stock, but there are 1,200 from which to choose.
Yeah.
Perhaps you'll take up the challenge and see if you can't get into the second time around.
Yeah, I think Don is close.
Great. Well, it's been such a pleasure to have the chance to talk to you today after being communicating for such a long time via personal
means. I know. Long overdue. Thank you so much for being interested to talk, and I love what you guys do and find great things to learn more about thanks to the work that you do.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much again, and please give Don our best regards.
I will. Okay. Happy New Year, and feel better, Anne.
Thanks, Wendy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that's a wrap for today's program. We hope you'll join us again, same time, same place, next week.
Bye-bye.